It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power with Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. This is your host, Mark Gillar. We have a very special guest today, Mr. Michael Shrimpton. He is a former British intelligence advisor who, frankly, has quite stirred up the birther controversy by revealing information regarding Obama's DNA. He has a new book coming out called Spy Hunter. We're going to want to talk to him about all of that. But without further ado, Michael Shrimpton, welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour.
Well, good evening. It's a pleasure to be on. I understand it's a very influential program, and it's particularly listened to by the intelligent wing of the Republican Party.
Well, I found out the other day that Ted Cruz was following me on Twitter, so I'm not sure what we can make of that.
Well, it's always encouraging to have the opposition listen to you on Twitter, or follow you on Twitter. He may not. If you ask me about his eligibility to be President of the United States, he may not be happy with the answer I might be obliged to give you.
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the things bothering me right now is that so many people who were quick to point out Barack Obama's lack of eligibility are supporting Ted Cruz. And in order to avoid hypocrisy, one has to apply the standard on both sides of the political aisle.
Absolutely. And I've always made that point very carefully in relation to Obama, because I also queried the eligibility of Senator McCain, who was his opponent in 2008.
I see. Well, I don't feel that I did you justice with that introduction, so I'd like you to take as much time as you need to tell my audience, which is primarily a highly conservative Tea Party audience, a little bit about yourself and how you found yourself in a position to make these observations and to obtain this intelligence on Barack Obama.
Well, I'm in American terms what you would call a neocon or neoconservative, i.e. An intelligent liberal who became a conservative, because if you have a brain and you're a liberal, your opinions inevitably move to the right, as you appreciate that the facts don't equate with your beliefs. So intelligent liberals change their beliefs. I'm a little bit like Dick Cheney in terms of politics. He started out on the left. He was a trade union organizer at one point. I started out at university in the Conservatives. I then moved under the pressures of unemployment and some very silly educational policies into the arms of the Labour Party. It was a huge mistake. I was a Labour parliamentary candidate in 1987 and in the European elections in 1989. But I've always been a Eurosceptic. It was one of the reasons I joined the Labour Party. When I joined Labour, they were opposed to British membership of the EEC, i.e. they had an intelligent, sensible position on EEC membership. The Tory party didn't. And as a Eurosceptic, I fell foul of the John Smith regime. John Smith beat a very nice man called Brian Gould, who went out to New Zealand. He was originally a Kiwi. And John Smith made it clear to me that there was no role for me in the Labour Party, and I eventually defected to the Tories in 97. So that's my politics. I'm currently a member of the Tory party. My day job is a barrister. I was called to the bar in 1983. But my real job, I suppose, is involved in intelligence. You were kind enough to mention my new book, Spy Hunter. That was published in England by June Press, if you'll forgive the advert, the 15th of April. It's only available at the moment from June Press's website, junepress.com. Or from amazon.co.uk. Amazon in the States are blocking it at the moment. Obviously, we're hoping for a US distributor. The book's a 700-page intelligence text. It's taken me 3 years to write, and it's based on my experiences in the world of intelligence, which really go back to 1997, 98, and the British bid to save Rolls-Royce. I had bought a Bentley. I formed the customer buyout consortium for Rolls-Royce Motors. There was intelligence involvement in that. I became aware of a covert German operation down in near Munich. I eventually discovered its name, the Deutsche Verteidigungsdienst, and I appreciated that German intelligence had not been shut down in 1945. And from then, matters moved on to the Pinochet case. I had the privilege of representing General Pinochet, the nicest dictator I've ever met, and the privilege of representing General Pinochet in Washington in negotiations with Dick Walters. Dick had been a former deputy director of the CIA, wonderful man. Dick and I got on very well together, and I successfully negotiated General Pinochet's return to Chile. Then I found myself advising spies. I had a small spy practice. Then I got involved in teaching spies. I'm not a spy myself, but I've represented them. I taught spies on the adjunct faculty of the American Military University. And then I found myself being invited to intelligence conferences, and I've had publications in the field. So I've had quite a fair bit of involvement in the world of intelligence in one way or another over the last 17 years.
Obviously, one develops quite a number of contacts after that long a period in that field.
Yes. Well, several hundred of my former students are in various U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies, which occasionally drives intelligence bureaucrats nuts. I will occasionally get emails addressed to Professor Shrimpton, and I will, if anybody addresses me as Professor Shrimpton, I'm certainly never called Professor Shrimpton in England. It wouldn't be appropriate anyways. We have a different definition of professor. You need a chair in England to be a professor. I don't mean a lounge chair, but you,
I understand.
Professor in England is a slightly more exalted status than it is in the United States. It's a courtesy title regularly extended to what in England would be termed lecturers, so I suppose my role was senior lecturer, I suppose, would be the rough equivalent. But no, if I get an email from Professor Shrimpton, I know it comes from a former student. And it was students of mine in a master's intelligence class who worked out TWA 800 to the discomfiture of the CIA and the State Department, partly because students were taking unclassified material out of the CIA library, bringing them in to our online class, in effect. And we were able to, with the assistance of U.S. Navy intelligence officers who'd been on the scene in the USS Normandy and in a P-3 Orion orbiting overhead, we were able to piece together exactly how the Iranians shot down TWA 800. That piece of analysis that was widely accepted in the intelligence community, but is not known about publicly, which is a shame. Had it been known about publicly, we might have lost fewer lives over the South China Sea when a Malaysian 777 was shot down in exactly the same way, using exactly the same missile, a modified version made in China and Iran of the AIM-54 Phoenix, and fired from the same class of submarine, a Kilo, in that case a Chinese Kilo.
Why do you think it has not been more publicly known? I mean, why is the media suppressing this?
Yeah, the mainstream media will suppress the truth if they don't like where it takes them. The mainstream media are vulnerable to pressure. A concentration of media ownership is a problem on both sides of the Atlantic. But mainstream media journalists tend to be liberal, and like most liberals, they suffer from the a lack of intellectual rigor. If they don't like where a conclusion takes them, then they will either suppress the truth they just back off the topic. TWA 800, the media never, the minute anyone got off the subject of the U.S. Navy shooting down TWA 800, which was absurd. I mean, there was never, and as I told my class when we looked at 800, there's no way in the world the U.S. Navy would shoot down an airliner. And if they did by accident, if there was some mischance and a missile went off course and hit an airliner, there'd be public acknowledgement of it. You couldn't keep something like that quiet in the U.S. Navy. It's a very well-run Navy, and Americans, you are the good guys. And if a U.S. Navy ship were to accidentally bring down an airliner, it would get out. So the U.S. Navy had no involvement at all in 800. Once the media realized that although the plane had been shot down, it had not been shot down by the U.S. Navy, but by somebody else's Navy, then interest died away completely. And certainly there was no appetite in the mainstream media to go after Iran. And we now know it was an Iranian submarine which shot down the airliner.
Well, you have to understand the American media has a blame America first policy, and anything that violates that doesn't get coverage.
Well, it's like the BBC. We understand that. It's like the BBC in England. The BBC wouldn't dream of reporting the truth on TWA 800. And the BBC is just as bad as the CBS and NBC and ABC. And they will report any nonsense on, for example, Malaysian 317. It doesn't matter how nonsensical the claim is. They'll just trot it out if it comes from an official body. They don't stop to analyze it. We had wreckage in the South Indian Ocean. At no point did anyone in the media say, hang on, the plane couldn't have reached that far south in the Indian Ocean. Its fuel tanks would not have been full. We were treated to all sorts of range diagrams, and British newspapers were, no doubt American newspapers were doing exactly the same, all sorts of fancy diagrams showing the maximum range of the plane. But it was only on a 2,500-mile flight to Peking. Its fuel tanks would not have been full. You know, this is a basic point. As an aviation intelligence specialist, I understand that. If I'm asked to determine what is the maximum range an aircraft could have flown to, I don't ask what is its fuel capacity and then go from the capacity. I ask what was actually in the tanks. With airliners, airliners are not normally for short to medium-haul flights, and this was a medium-haul flight. For a medium-haul flight, you don't fill the tanks on an airliner. It's pointless. It's dangerous, pardon me, because you're just adding weight. Mm-hmm. You're just putting in fuel that you don't need. You're adding weight to an airplane for no point. It's expensive. The real reason it's done by airlines is to save money, because you have to carry the fuel.
Makes sense.
Yes, exactly. Why would you carry 50 or 100 tons of fuel you don't want?
No, that's true, and I can tell you that I was once bumped off a flight because the airlines said that given the drastic weather conditions, they were going to have to fill their tanks much closer to capacity for this particular trip because they anticipated needing more fuel given the weather. So, yes, I know they do not.
Exactly. There was no adverse weather in relation to MH370. There's no way in the world that the Malaysian Airlines would have filled the tanks to capacity. Therefore, we can dispense with calculations based on the maximum range of the 777. We know what the maximum range of the 777 is. It can fly over 7,000 nautical miles, depending on load. What we want to know is how far could it have reached with the fuel it actually had. It doesn't have in-flight refueling capacity. But to listen to the BBC, you would think that the airline had been had a rendezvous over the Indian Ocean with a tanker. All of a sudden, thousands of pounds of fuel was magically being transferred to this aircraft. Extraordinary. The media wrote off the wreckage. There was a hatch. I'm well aware that we're getting off the topic of President Obama, and we'll get back to the topic. I'm sure you'll bring me back to the topic very quickly.
We're about to do that, but go ahead and finish this.
Well, there was wreckage from a Boeing 777 under the flight path. There was a hatch, and it's from a 777. And, of course, Boeing have been asked, where's this wreckage from? And, of course, Boeing have said, it's from a 777. We don't know if it's a 200, a 300, or a 100, but it's from a 777, because these things are tooled by computers. You work things down to the nearest inch. Boeing work in inches. I suspect the 777 is probably metric, but they normally work in inches. But inches or metric, you would have the dimensions of a hatch down to a very fine scale indeed. It's got to fit the opening apart from anything else. Boeing know how big the hatch is on a 777, and they were able to do estimates on the hatch that surfaced and say, yes, that's from one of our 777s. The wreckage that appeared miraculously in the Indian Ocean had been dropped out of the back of, firstly, a C-5, I think, out of Diego Garcia, or a C-17. Then the French had to go dropping bits of wreckage somewhere else, and then the Chinese, everybody was dropping wreckage all over the Indian Ocean. It was a complete farce. And the intelligence community knows what's going on, because all of this is picked up on satellite, as indeed was the shoot-down of 370. But there we are.
Okay, well, I can hear my audience. By the way, this is very fascinating, but I know my audience, and I know why they tuned in to listen to you today, and again, this was a nice bonus, but right now they're going, Mark, get to the birth certificate, get to the DNA.
That was the bonus, like in a supermarket, buy one, get one free.
Absolutely. And I enjoyed it.
Get to the birth issue. The question you want to ask me is, where was Barack Hussein Obama born? Well, the answer is obvious. It was Mombasa, Kenya. He was born, there we are, we're not wasting time, are we? We're cutting to the chase.
Cut right to it.
So far as I am aware, and this is an opinion shared widely within British intelligence, obviously not publicly, but nobody in British intelligence who wanted to retain face or credibility would say that he was born in Honolulu on August 4th, 1961. This is obvious nonsense. So far as I am aware, his date of birth is August 4th, or 4th August, since this is an American audience, 4th August 1960, the previous year to the claimed date of birth. The place of birth is Mombasa. We think it's in a hospital in Mombasa, but there are no surviving medical records. Such records as did survive have been spirited away by the Kenyan government. Mombasa then, this is misunderstood by WND and a few other people commenting on this issue. Mombasa then was not part of the British Empire. Mombasa was part of the Sultanate of Zanzibar. Kenya is composed of two components. Kenya Colony, which was part of the British Empire, which we captured from the Germans in 1918, well, in World War One, and that obviously brought with it an existing German intelligence network who eventually organized the Mau Mau terrorist campaign. Obama's father was involved in the Mau Mau terrorist campaign, which is why we had intelligence files on the father, which is why we knew that one of his mistresses had given birth to a son in Mombasa, because he was under surveillance, and so was the mistress.
Let me, Michael, make a quick point regarding the possibility of a Mombasa birth. We've had, I'm glad you explained this misunderstanding, because both Jerome Corsi had gone to England to search the records, the archives, and Christopher Monckton had also looked and had found nothing there, and the assumption was that because Kenya was part of the British Empire at that time, that there, if those records didn't exist in the archives, then he was not born in Mombasa. But you're now telling us that his birth record would not have been in the UK archives.
Correct. There are two reasons for that. I've spoken to Jerry Corsi about this. He's a nice guy. We've had a bit of a row this week because he had a go at me on WND. So my relations with Jerry Corsi are not warm at the moment, as anyone who reads the email traffic passing between me and him over the last 48 hours will be aware of. I'm sure that's caused a certain amount of amusement at NSA and GCHQ and Siemens in Munich. My emails are usually read. Jerry had a pop at me, and I've had a pop back at him. So my relations with Jerry are not warm, but I respect the man's intelligence, and I respect his skills as a researcher. And he and I have discussed this over lunch at the Savoy Grill. He was buying. Since he's a millionaire, that was fair enough. I'm only a poor, humble barrister. He was kind enough to invite me to lunch at the Savoy Grill on his recent trip to London, and we discussed this. The problem with the archives is twofold. Firstly, it was assumed wrongly in the United States that Mombasa was part of the Kenya colony. It wasn't. Mombasa was part of the Sultanate of Zanzibar, and responsibility for such registration of births and deaths as there was rested not with the British authorities, but with the Zanzibari authorities. Obama at birth was a subject of His Highness the Sultan of Zanzibar. The coastal protectorate of Kenya, Mombasa was in the coastal protectorate. And the coastal protectorate was part of the Sultan's domains. Because it was a protectorate, Britain was responsible for its external protection and foreign policy. But people born inside a protectorate were British protected persons, not British subjects. They retained the nationality of the sovereign. And the sovereign was, in the case of Zanzibar, His Highness the Sultan. He was later overthrown, but in 1960 it was the Sultan. Now, it follows that British registration procedures for births and deaths would not be followed because it wasn't British territory. Technically, it was foreign soil. Say, on the map, for example, Zanzibar, the coastal protectorate would not have been coloured in pink on a map. Kenya was coloured pink because it was a colony, part of the empire. The protectorate was not part of the empire. Although subject to British, it was in the British sphere of influence. It's a bit like France and Germany. France is in the German sphere of influence, but France retains a nominal president and is nominally an independent country, although Germany, in fact, controls its policy. I know the French don't agree with that, but that's the reality of the matter. Or the Ukraine is another German client state. So Zanzibar was effectively a British client state, but it was nonetheless a state. The second error was to assume that native, and I use the word native for the benefit of the transcript, I'll put inverted commas around native because the politically correct brigade don't like it and see it as a racist expression, which it isn't. It was an expression in common use in the British Empire. It simply referred to native, in inverted commas, populations, i.e. the local population, as opposed to the British or European population. Native, in inverted commas, births were not recorded. They should have been, but in practice, registration of native births and deaths was very much a local affair left to chiefs or local administration. It wasn't something that concerned the colonial authorities. Even in Kenya Colony, we would not have expected the birth of a child to the mistress of a native, in inverted commas, to be recorded. Only European births and deaths were routinely recorded. So for those two reasons, we would not expect to find anything in the British archives.
And if that's the case, how are you so certain that he was born in Mombasa?
Oh, because the intelligence is overwhelming. This has come from multiple intelligence sources. Both MI5 and MI6 ended up with the intelligence records from the Coastal Protectorate, and my understanding is that both MI5 and MI6 records show a birth to the man you know as Barack Hussein Obama on 4th August 1960.
Okay. Now, it sounds like you certainly have the proof you need that a child born to the mistress of Barack Hussein Obama Senior, as we call him, was born in Mombasa. But how do we know that that birth is the birth of Barack Hussein Obama Jr., or as we call him, President Obama? Could it not have been another child?
Well, no, because Barack Hussein Obama Sr. was involved in the Mau Mau. He wasn't a Mau Mau terrorist. He was involved in terrorist gun running and financing. He was a link man to the German network in Nairobi, which controlled the Mau Mau. The Mau Mau were sponsored by Germany. The Barack Hussein Obama Sr. was under close surveillance. So we have the British intelligence files on Obama Sr. have a clear picture of which children were born to him and when. We know that he did not take a child with him to the United States, and we know that no child was born in Honolulu. So we can safely rule out. It's a process of elimination. The child born to the mistress in 1960 is this Barack Hussein Obama, because there is no other credible candidate.
So how did the Dunhams get involved?
The Dunhams were German agents. It's impossible to understand the Obama controversy without bringing in an understanding that German intelligence was not shut down in 1945, that the new agency, the DVD, took over the Abwehr and its overseas networks, and that Germany is very much involved in high-yield offshore trading, which does such immense damage to the British and American economies. It's why we have such huge inflation and have had since the end of World War II. Dunham, the maternal grandmother, or the claimed maternal grandmother, Madeleine. Yeah. Madeleine was a German agent in World War II and was involved in the sabotage of Boeing B-29s at Wichita, Kansas. Now, your listeners will not need me to tell you, to tell them what a B-29 was. The B-29 Super Fortress, wonderful aircraft designed by Boeing in 42-43, entered service in or around June 1944. Now, Boeing manufactured the B-29 at several. There were B-29s are manufactured in a number of plants. It was a very major program. There were two major Boeing plants at Renton and Wichita, Kansas. It was also manufactured by Bell. Boeing, unlike Consolidated, now you'll all be familiar with the, I should say all y'all, this is an American program, all y'all will be familiar with the Boeing Consolidated, the Consolidated B-24 Liberator, wonderful airplane. Consolidated's blueprints were a mess. Anybody who ever worked in a Liberator will tell you their blueprints had bits added, bits taken off, and the same set of blueprints was used wherever the B-24 was made. Boeing were a much tidier company and produced separate blueprints for each plant and separate blueprints for each model. And we know that the set of blueprints that was handed to the Soviets by German intelligence, which led to the Soviets manufacturing their own version of the B-29 called the Tu-4, we know that was a Wichita model. They had the full designation of Boeing B-29 wouldn't just be B-29, it would be B-29A-BW, which would stand for Boeing Wichita, or it might be a different designation for Bell and a different designation for Boeing in Seattle. The B-29 blueprints were stolen by a German agent out of the Wichita, Kansas plant, and the FBI at the time sourced the theft to Madeleine Dunham. Now, there's partly a religious connection to German intelligence, but there's a close family connection to German intelligence, and as I say, it goes all the way back. You're going way, way back to World War II. And she carried on working for German intelligence after the war. And the initiative to pass off Obama as Anne Dunham's baby almost certainly came from within German intelligence and was channeled via Madeleine. It was almost certainly the grandmother's idea, not the mother's, and she would have been asked to do it by someone in the DVD.
Now, let me ask you a question. Why was it so important to pass off Barack Hussein Obama's baby to anyone?
That's one of the mysteries. It is not entirely clear what the motive was, but we know that Hussein Obama Sr. was quite an important German asset. In fact, they eventually got the Kenyans to assassinate him because he started talking. We know that he carried a lot of intelligence in his head about the German links to the Mau Mau.
So that car wreck where he died, supposedly?
Oh, yeah, he was assassinated, yeah. The car wreck was an organized car wreck. And that was set up by the Kenyans out of Nairobi. Now, it's very unclear exactly, the exact motivation is unclear. All we do know is that Barack Hussein Obama cannot be the son of Anne Dunham because she wasn't pregnant in July 1961 and the birth was in August. And as I explained in the video, which someone apparently in CIA, you know, it went viral after someone in CIA apparently leaked it to a website. I wasn't involved in that particular leak at all. I didn't know it had gone viral until somebody said, oh, by the way, there are 2 million hits a day on your video. And I had to say, well, what video? It was a video, the presentation that I'd given to the Marlborough Research Group in 2008 in England. And it had only been seen by a few hundred people on YouTube, and then all of a sudden was being seen by 2 million people a day.
Very quickly, how do we know that Stanley Ann Dunham was not pregnant in July?
Because the CIA had obtained a photograph of her. When I raised this with the CIA and the DIA, I did suggest that somebody go looking for class photographs. They said, well, why would anyone retain a photograph? I said, students at American universities in 1960-61 would be taking photographs of each other. There's bound to be a yearbook photograph or a photograph taken by a friend. There will be a photographic record of Anne Dunham dating from 1961. It'll only be a couple of snapshots. And it turned out that was right, and there's apparently a snapshot of her at a beach, which I believe is Waikiki Beach in Oahu in 1961, dated reliably to about July of 1961.
Well, I would assume she would be showing a month before the birth.
Yes, and she wasn't. At that stage, according to the White House, Anne Dunham should have been 8 months pregnant, but I believe that we have a photograph of her in a fairly fetching bikini on Waikiki Beach in July, and there ain't no pregnancy visible at all. Hmm. So, you know, he can't. I've heard of premature births, but we don't. You don't have a brain at 4 weeks. Now, since he's a Democrat, I suppose we could pass over
right.
the lack of a brain, but you also don't have arms and legs, and since he has arms and legs, we know the president went fairly clearly. We certainly know he went to the third trimester. As far as I know, it was a delivery at full term. He was not a premature baby. Anne Dunham wasn't pregnant. Now, the other reason we know Anne Dunham wasn't pregnant, in the United States, which the CIA actually told me this, I pretty much understood it anyway, but the CIA did say, well, yes, in the United States, women would normally have an attending physician at birth. It's not like England, where we use midwives. In 1960 in England, there would not normally be a doctor present at birth. In the United States, certainly for middle-class women, there would be an attending physician, usually.
Yeah.
Perhaps not in the Midwest, miles from the nearest doctor, but certainly in Honolulu, we'd expect there to be a doctor. And we'd also expect there to be medical records. It would be unusual for an American middle-class teenager to go through an illegitimate birth, even an illegitimate birth, without at some point mentioning it to her doctor and without there being some form of medical record.
Well, do we know that there is not some form because there is a name of the doctor on the long-form birth certificate posted?
The name of the doctor who has intelligence connections of his own. The doctor was a family friend. There's the name of a doctor which eventually emerged after years of pressing for it. But what there isn't is the supporting medical records. And I know that CIA went and looked at those records, and my understanding is, of course I don't have the records, but my understanding is that there is no reference at all to a pregnancy on Anne Dunham's medical records. Another missing gap. President Obama has put forward two different hospitals at various times. it's not as though he's being consistent. Indeed, at one point, he himself acknowledged that he was born in Kenya. I think that was included, was it not, in the biography of a book?
Actually, it was a literary agent who represented him to publishers in hopes of landing a book deal. And they according to him, he was misrepresented that way for 16 years.
Well, I'm not buying. Firstly, I've just written a book myself. The first thing the publishers do, the last thing the publisher does while publishing is send you the galley proofs. And the galley proofs include the cover. So the idea that he never saw the galley proofs of the book before it was published is a little bit, that's a bit of a stretch, frankly. And he certainly would have read the book. The publisher would automatically send him a copy of the book. And if there's a gross error, if you're an American citizen and you've written a book and you're claiming to be an American citizen and your publisher has you down born as an alien in Kenya, you would get hold of the publisher and say, right, check that for the next imprint.
I mean, again, I don't know that this was ever put as part of a book. What I'm stating is that the literary agent who represented him in D.C. Had a book in which they contained the biographies of many, many authors, and Barack Hussein Obama Jr. was one of those authors, and it clearly states that he was Kenyan-born. Yeah. Now, they now claim, in fact, within 24 hours of Breitbart.com releasing that information, the woman who was the one of the partners said that at that time she was just a simple clerk and that was her error and that she did not get that information from Barack Hussein Obama Jr., but she also doesn't state where she received it. Well, and we're supposed to believe when other authors represented by that same literary agency said they had to sign off on a proof before their information was put in that book, that she just made up some stuff on Obama and never bothered to show it to him. It's a complete load of crap, if you'll pardon my language. The woman
you
is lying.
That I'm not buying. I'm sorry. That makes no sense at all. And why would you say he was born in Kenya if you hadn't got that from Obama himself?
Exactly.
Or someone close to him. He was born in Kenya. So she puts down an accurate representation as to his date of birth. I'm sorry. I'm not buying. I was about to make the point that the two different claims as to the hospital in which he was born, there are no hospital admission records. For a birth in hospital, American hospitals are well run, particularly in Hawaii. Hawaii is a pretty well run state. There's no way, I mean, it's not, you know, we're not talking Massachusetts. It's a well run state. There are no liberals involved in running it, on the whole. You would expect there to be a admissions record. I mean, the idea that 18-year-old girls wander into an American hospital and give birth to a baby and there's no physician records and there's no attendance records and there's no hospital admission records, just a nonsense.
Well, let me jump in again.
Apart from anything else, American hospitals bill. Somebody has to, either an insurance company or the parents or the girl has to pay up. You can't just wander into America. I don't believe that you can wander.
No one is suggesting that she did, Michael. What Capilani is officially saying, and I know this because I'm pretty close to the cold case posse investigation on this, is that when Mike Zullo and a member of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office went to Capilani, they were told that the records only went back 25 years so that they would not be able to help Mr. Zullo in his efforts to find out.
I'm sure that's what they... I have no doubt if Mike Zullo says that's what he was told. Mike Zullo is a good people, very nice guy. We've not met, but we've spoken on the phone. I'm sure that's what Mike was told. But again, I have some... I have doubts about that. The attending physician's records would probably not be scrubbed. It just beggars belief that there could be no written record surviving of attendance at a hospital.
I would agree with you, and there have been sources within Capilani that dispute that, but
yes,
that's about all I can say on that.
Hospitals know it's a political hot potato. The hospitals are, I'm aware the hospitals, of both hospitals have pushed the line. There was no, our records don't go back that far. I'm sorry, I'm not buying. Apart from anything else, in the 1960s, records could be microfiched.
Now, You've got some very interesting information, but I have to ask, is this information that was passed on to you simply by word of mouth through other intelligence people, or have you seen anything tangible that would suggest to you that what you've been told by other members of the intelligence community is correct?
You're never shown the... I mean, there are occasions where I've had discussions with CIA officers, and I have seen, for example, tear-off sheets of the master German slush fund in... Geneva is a company called SCB Charcoal, SBC Charcoal is a very important company, SBC Charcoal SA, but I have not, no, you are never, normally you are not shown the raw data. It would be contrary to all intelligence practice. If I'd been allowed to keep a copy of it, it would make me more powerful than the American president, wouldn't it? Because I would be in a position to blackmail the American president and dictate to him his policies. No, intelligence agencies do not hand out raw data. They don't normally allow people access to the raw data. The DNA test the CIA did is in a slightly different category. On that, I own the intelligence because it was my idea. And I was consulted by the CIA and DIA and gave them that advice. And at that stage, I probably had as much expertise in DIA analysis as... I was a chairman of the Immigration Appeal Tribunal, and we did, and formerly an immigration judge. And as an immigration judge, we were dealing with DNA cases all day long. I was the second lawyer in the world to use DNA in a case in 1985, when I dealt with the person who invented DNA fingerprinting, Alec Jeffries, at the University of Leicester. So my experience when the CIA... invited me to lunch, and the DIA, I think the CIA picked up the tab.
I've had 20 You're really good about remembering who picked up the tab.
I'm a poor, humble barrister. I'm sure I do know the CIA were buying. I didn't pick up the tab. We were at Claridge's. It was quite a large tab. It was a very good lunch. Claridge's, the CIA liked Claridge's because it's close to the American embassy. The CIA... The largest CIA station in Britain, of course, is at RAF Mildenhall, but the CIA station in London is quite large, and because it covers Europe as well as the UK. And their favourite hotel, for serious lunches, their favourite hotels are Claridge's or the Connaught. Now, the Connaught is not as well known as Claridge's, but it's equidistant just about from the US Embassy, and it's very civilised, and it's a little bit quieter than Claridge's.
So let me ask this. You say you own the intelligence. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I own the intelligence in the sense that I came up with the idea of using wine and water glasses to do the DNA, and it was my idea based on many, many cases as a judge of determining relationship as claimed. Now, those cases were peculiarly, almost peculiar to Britain. Other countries would have dealt with them, but we had a huge raft of cases, probably more than any other country in the world, of bogus attempts to get into Britain, usually from the Indian subcontinent, with fake claimed relationships. We also had a major problem with the West Indies, and because Britain was the former imperial power of the West Indies and India, partly because of old imperial connections, partly because it's an English-speaking country and attractive, we had a lot of illegal immigration, a lot of attempted illegal immigration, and a lot of the immigrants into Britain in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s were coming from the Indian subcontinent and the West Indies. And there was an industry in both jurisdictions of making up forged birth certificates and putting forward fake claimed relationships. And British immigration judges were probably dealing with these sort of cases more than the immigration judiciary of any other country. So we had acquired substantial expertise as a body of judges by 2007 in immigration appeal, in DNA. And before I stopped sitting at the end of 2003, I had acquired significant personal experience of DNA. So it was my idea.
Or you suggested to them that we need to use wine and water glasses to get the DNA. They took your advice, the results came back, and then they told you what?
He'd failed. There was no relationship between him and Anne Dunham. Now, obviously Anne Dunham by then had died, but the grandmother was still alive. There was no dispute that Anne Dunham was the daughter of the grandmother. Anne is clearly Madeleine's daughter. Therefore, there would have to be a DNA comparison between Obama's DNA and Madeleine Dunham's DNA. And
what year was this done, Michael?
Sorry?
What year was this done?
This was done 2000. I think the I'm being slightly cautious, merely because the officers were then attached to the U.S. Embassy. It does not follow that they're now covert. I have been deliberately vague about the dates because I don't want to identify the officers. That's A, courtesy, B, good practice, and C, might, because they might now be covert, they might have done the opposite to Valerie Plame and gone from covert to overt. Valerie Plame was not protected by the Intelligence Identities Protection Act because she was an analyst only. She'd left the covert side of the CIA many, many years before. But these officers may have gone over from being under official cover to non-official cover. Their identity may be protected by the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. So I'm being very vague about the... I'm quite happy to give the location of the lunch, but I'm being very vague about the dates, and I'm certainly not giving out the identities of the officers I dealt with. But the DNA test, as I understood it, was done in early 2008.
Early 2008. So, and of course, most people will remember that Madeleine Dunham passed away. I beg your pardon?
She passed away later that year, yes.
Yes, later that year, during the election, Obama had to take time out from the election.
Correct, but the test was done after, I became aware of Obama's birth in Kenya way, way back when he was still an Illinois senator. And remember, I was sitting on the Immigration Appeal Tribunal with Africa hands. I certainly knew one or two of the old Africa hands.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I mean African intelligence hands. And I was aware, it was remarked upon in the British Intelligence Committee that there was an American state senator claiming to be born in Honolulu when, in fact, he was born in Mombasa. It was a bit of a joke. So, this is seen as rather amusing.
Now, at that time, there was no interest in Barack Hussein Obama Jr. per se. This was information, as I understand it, from what you've told me, that was known because of his father and perhaps his grandmother.
Correct. The intelligence, it was, as far as we were concerned, it was the father who was of interest. Barack Hussein Obama was of no British intelligence interest until he suddenly popped up as a state senator for Illinois. And it was very obvious he was ambitious. And people started to take note of we're going back 14 years. I became aware that he was born in Kenya. Probably around about the turn of the century. He then becomes an American senator, and at that point it started to become a bit serious. I don't think I ever looked up the qualifications for a state senator in Illinois. I don't think you have to be a U.S. citizen to be a state senator in Illinois.
You do not have to be an American citizen to be a state senator, nor do you have to be an American citizen to be a U.S. senator. But you do have to be an American citizen. And by the way, let's clarify this, not just an American citizen. American citizen can mean native-born, naturalized, or natural-born.
Well, I have some recollection. I did approach, because I had given advice to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. I have some recollection of contacting General Counsel's office at the Senate. It might have been the Intelligence Committee or it might have been General Counsel's office. I was slightly concerned when he became a U.S. Senator,
mm-hmm.
because I had some understanding I can't pretend to have looked up the U.S. Constitution on that subject, but I had some understanding that you had to be a U.S. citizen to be a U.S. Senator. Are you saying that you don't have to be a U.S. citizen to be a senator?
That's not my understanding.
I'll be right. I wouldn't express a view either way on that. Because I had some understanding that you had to be a U.S. citizen, it certainly occurred to me that it was wrong for someone to be in the U.S. Senate on the basis of a false statement as to place and date of birth. And I did raise the issue. But
if he falsified his place of birth and committed a felony in doing so,
yes.
I believe that would make him ineligible for the U.S. Senate, but it would be the falsification.
Thank you. I think that was the concern. It wasn't that he was ineligible per se. It was that a false statement on his nomination papers, he'd been elected effectively on the basis of a false prospectus. And that did raise an issue as to his eligibility to be in the United States Senate. It all started to get a little more serious when he became a United States Senator, and we couldn't understand in England why nobody had picked this up. And we thought, well, the CIA is asleep. what was happening. When he gave that speech in 2004, it was very obvious to everybody over here that this man was intending to be president. And although the thinking in Britain was that Hillary Clinton would be the Democratic nominee, the view was that she'd be a shoo-in, by the fall of 2007, it was becoming clear that Obama had serious ambitions to run. And my approach, the CIA's approach to me, or my approach to the CIA, and I can't remember now who spoke to whom, I had dealings with intelligence officers all the time, intelligence agencies. I can't now recall whether I said to someone in CIA, what the hell's going on, if you'll forgive my language, what's going on? I mean, there's nobody picked up this birth issue. This guy's not eligible to be president. Or whether the CIA came to me. The invitation for lunch was from the CIA to me, but there were prior discussions. I know CIA, before the luncheon invitation was issued, CIA did their own checks and realized, uh-oh, we have a problem.
Okay, they realized they have a problem.
They wouldn't have spent the money on me at lunch at Claridge's. The CIA didn't invite me to lunch at Claridge's just because they like me. Not everybody in CIA likes me anyway.
Well, let me ask the million-dollar question then. If the CIA knew that he was not legit, and they know now that he was not legit, and they've got DNA evidence to prove that, what's their motivation for not bringing this president down and getting the imposter out of the White House?
Because they did a deal. That's why I raised it publicly at the Marlborough Group briefing. Dirty pool was played at Langley. Somebody, obviously I know who cut the deal, somebody at Langley cut a deal with Obama. And that deal involved the future leadership of the CIA. I'm being very cautious on it.
you're not being that cautious.
This is a radio program. I'm not going to go naming names on your program. I don't want your lawyers to have a heart attack, so I don't want to cause another coronary. I've already caused one coronary, if I'm not a coronary. Caused a tachycardic episode for the Attorney General of the United States. Apparently, it was shown to him, and he had a tachycardic episode and was rushed to hospital. I don't want to cause tachycardic episodes amongst other U.S. lawyers.
Well, frankly, we have a lot of latitude in what we say about public officials here.
You do, but I don't. I work on the British law of libel, and if I make a statement in England, I'm being interviewed in England. So I always operate under the English laws of libel. That way I know I'm safe. I'm not naming names. It would be discourteous anyway, because the man is a friend of friends. And he has his supporters, and let's just say a deal was done. I became aware of the deal. Mm-hmm. It was thought that I wouldn't have the ability to get through to Hillary Clinton. And why they thought that, I don't know, because I do have contacts in the Democratic Party. It wasn't terribly difficult for me to get through to, firstly, Bill Clinton's people in Washington, because I've been around Washington since, I landed on my feet in Washington. I started dealing on the Pinochet case with the Sandy Berger's office at the White House. I rang on the direct line. First thing the nice lady at the other end of the phone asked was, how did you get this number, sir? She was very polite. I think she said, sir, how did you get this number? And I said, well, actually, one of Mr. Berger's predecessors was kind enough to give it to me. Oh, and at that point, she realized this man is a serious individual. And we had a discussion about the Pinochet case, and the White House obviously asked Dick Walters, who was known to his friends as Dick. Dick Walters was asked by the White House to go along on a deniable basis and have a chat with Shrimpton, which was all held in the lobby of the Willard Hotel in Washington. So I have been around Washington for some considerable time. I do have contacts in the Democratic Party. I rang one of my contacts. It was very entertaining. The first thing he said when it was me at the end of the line was, uh-oh. He knew it was trouble. And he said, this is trouble, isn't it, Michael? I said, yes, I'm afraid so. You have just nominated to be your candidate as president of the United States, someone who is not eligible and who is, in fact, a British subject. We're all tickled pink over here that you've selected a British subject. He's the first British subject to be president of the United States, or will be, if he's elected, since George Washington, who officially had given up his British subject status during the course of the rebellion of the 13 colonies, at some point he ceased to be a British subject. Your man is a British subject. He's a citizen of Kenya, makes him a British subject. He is certainly not a U.S. citizen. You might want to reconsider. And the CIA, by the way, have done a DNA test. And at that point, of course, the Democrats went away to CIA and verified from CIA that, yes, indeed, the boys had done a DNA test. Now, I got through to Bill Clinton's people in Washington. That wasn't terribly difficult.
When was this?
Oh, this was, now you're looking at 2008, just prior to the Marlborough Group video. The CIA had done the DNA test. The campaign was well underway. Obama was starting to look as though he was the front runner. I had warned Bill Clinton's people. Bill, I understand, now I wasn't party to the conversation, but Bill, I believe, verified it with Kofi Annan. Bill Clinton and Kofi Annan, who was former Secretary General, that bunch of clowns called the UN.
Yes.
Kofi, I think Kofi Annan is a slightly dodgy individual. I'm cautious of the English laws of libel. I'm not going
to
say anymore.
I was about to say. I thought we were being cautious today.
Being cautious. He's a slightly dodgy. I did say slightly dodgy, Mark. He's a slightly dodgy individual, the very greatest. Well, he's the Secretary General of the United Nations. You can't be Secretary General of the United Nations and not be a dodgy individual. I mean, the whole UN Charter was drawn up by a German spy called John Foster Dulles. The UN is a very dodgy organization indeed. Now, the Kofi Annan verified to Bill Clinton that the intelligence was correct. Whether my name is mentioned or not, I don't know. Kofi knew already that Obama was born in Mombasa. It's an open secret. African, every major player in African intelligence knows that Obama was born in Kenya. I don't think Kofi Annan had to check with anybody in Nairobi. He already knew. Bill Clinton then sat on it. And I was stuck here in England, and I obviously, this wasn't a major thing for me. I wasn't, you know, I had many other fish to fry. It was just one of the files. It was an open file. And sort of 3 or 4 weeks went by, and I thought, well, hang on, Obama's still in the campaign. Why isn't Hillary? And I thought, well, Hillary's obviously has been kept out of the loop. I wonder if Bill's holding out on Hillary. So I then got through to Hillary's people.
It wouldn't be the first secret he's kept from her.
Well, apparently it was a bust-up, and she sent him to campaign in the West Coast. He was sent out to California and Arizona to campaign for about 3 weeks. They weren't talking to each other. It was a big bust-up. And I'm sorry to say I may have triggered it, because I got through to a good friend of Hillary Clinton. And the way I did that was I rang up an old friend in Florida, sadly since died, a wonderful man called Leland Owens, gay. Don't hold that against him. You don't choose your sexuality. He was an awfully nice man. He was a millionaire. He lived in a wonderful house designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, which I'd visited. And Leland knew a good friend of Hillary Clinton's. And I rang Leland and said, Leland, I think you know someone who knows Hillary Clinton. And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, look, we've got this major problem, this bloke called Obama, who's running for office. He said, yeah, he's running for president. I said, yes, I know. And he is not eligible. Ah, tell me more. Well, he's actually born in Mombasa. I briefed him, Bill. I think Bill's holding out on Hillary. Can you get through to Hillary's friend and ask her to, as a lady friend, could you ask this lady to brief in Hillary as a courtesy? And I believe that was done. And then Bill Clinton, there's a sudden frost enters the Clinton relationship. Bill Clinton's on the West Coast. And Hillary went to, Hillary had somebody close to her go to CIA, verify that they had done a DNA test. And then there was a deal. Now, the problem was that I had underestimated the leverage which Obama had on Hillary Clinton. So Hillary was not able to force him out of the race, but they did a deal which involved Hillary becoming Secretary of State. And more importantly, it unpicked the deal about future leadership of the CIA. Hillary asked for and was given control of the CIA. And she put her own man in, a man called Leon Panetta. He was a fairly nice chap, but Leon is a fairly nice chap with respect, but he didn't fully understand the circumstances which led to him being director of the CIA. I think he thought it was because he was a brilliant intelligence officer. Had he looked more deeply into it and maybe dug more out of the guys who were briefing him in than he did, he might have realized that he probably ought to have been having me around for lunch as well. He never did me any favors, so I'm not particularly keen to, you know, I don't owe Leon Panetta anything. But that's how he's installed at the director of CIA.
Very well. Let's ask another million-dollar question. Obviously, there are more than a few people within the intelligence community in the United States, and it sounds like it's both FBI and CIA. that know the truth on this.
Yeah, I don't know about the FBI. No offense, the FBI are not very well informed at the best of times. They're not like the DEA. Probably the DEA, you know, because the DEA are wonderful people. Love talking to the DEA. They're just great people. I'm not sure. I've never spoken to anyone in the FBI about it. I think there is a slight problem in the FBI that many people in the FBI have integrity. Not everybody, of course, but there are a lot of agents, particularly below the top, who have integrity. And the problem with telling the FBI is that some agent might then get into his head to go around and arrest the Democratic candidate for president. I mean, I think there was a very strong determination to keep it out of the hands of the FBI. And I think some evidence of that was provided by the tachycardic episode sadly suffered by the Attorney General. I wasn't intending to cause him a tachycardic episode, indeed. What I was told may be wrong. It may be that the tachycardic episode didn't follow straight after the viewing of my video. I'm told it did. That may be wrong. But it looked to me as though the Attorney General was taken by surprise. I think he, to be more precise, I think he had a nasty shock. And I doubt that the FBI had ever briefed him in that Obama was not eligible to be president. I don't think the FBI were in the loop. CIA.
Very well. Okay, well, still, nevertheless, there are numerous people within the intelligence community in the United States who
not
know.
Just, also China and the Soviet and Russia.
If you'll let me finish the question, you'll see why I'm asking particularly about the United States. Are there any people with integrity within the United States intelligence community that if they were, in fact, put on a witness stand, would tell the truth?
Yes, and they're the same people who arranged for my video to go viral. I didn't know it was going viral. I had nothing to do with that. My video was taken. The CIA knew it was a genuine video. They knew that my briefing was correct. They knew that, obviously, they knew about the conversation I'd had with them. And it was somebody in CIA, opposed to Brennan and Obama, who ensured that video reached the American people.
And in the name of saving America from an imposter, would you turn or give some of those names to, for example, Sheriff Arpaio, Mike Zullo, so that these people could be subpoenaed and put on a witness stand?
Names I don't give. It's a fundamental rule of intelligence work. You don't hand out names. I am, however, prepared to back up my statements on oath. Not only am I prepared to do it, I'm in the process. I'm on holiday vacation next week, but my first task on return from vacation in Scotland will be, assuming the plane isn't blown up on the way to Scotland or the way back, assuming the aeroplane is not blown up and I'm not shot on a Scottish moor somewhere, my first task will be to prepare an affidavit, and I am giving evidence in a case in the King's County Division of the State Supreme Court of New York on the 17th and 18th of June.
Very well. Do you think that there is anyone else within the intelligence community that might be willing to come forward and take similar action?
Very possibly. There is major concern because it now transpires that Snowden took a copy of the DNA report. Remember, DIA were at the lunch at Claridge's. The DIA report went to NSA, who are awfully nice people. Meade had a copy, but Meade's copy was, unfortunately, I believe, it was computerized. Trust Meade. They love computers at Meade. They stick everything on a computer. Snowden, who was working, bear it in mind, in the field of information technology, Snowden, who had high-level access at Meade, Snowden acquired, I believe, an electronic copy of the DNA report.
Why do you believe that?
Well, because it's ended up in Moscow, and he took some very powerful intelligence from Hong Kong to Moscow, and I'm aware that he was in negotiations with the SVR head of station in Hong Kong, and I'm aware that Snowden and Putin have been in direct communication, which was partly proved last week when Snowden turned up on a TV program. Putin was advertising to everybody the fact that he's been having talks with Snowden, and I'm talking to the Russians.
Okay, now very quickly, whenever Snowden was still in Hong Kong and attempting to travel to Russia and to negotiate asylum, political asylum, albeit...
The deal was done before he left Hong Kong.
Right, yeah, albeit temporary, I think, for 1 year. At that point, if he had the DNA information and he's trying to prove how corrupt the American government is, why not just go public with it or threaten the United States to go public with it and state, hey, I want to come back to the United States. I want this matter to be dropped or I'm going to release this information. I mean, it seems like with that kind of power in his hand, he wouldn't have needed Russia as a middleman.
Yeah, I think he had ambitions to carry on living. Okay. He took the right. I think his choice. I think he knew that he was a stuffed bunny, if you want to give the expression, in the United States. I think his approach to the matter was entirely sensible from his perspective. I held no brief for Snowden. He's a traitor, but I think from his own personal perspective, he obviously came to the conclusion he'd be a lot safer off in Russia. He first fled to China. Remember, he's working for the Chinese. He's a Chinese agent. He first handed the copy to the Chinese. Now, this may explain, of course, his reluctance to go public in America. Snowden has a lot to hide. Snowden first gave the intelligence to the Chinese, which explains why the Chinese have had such warm dealings with the Obama administration. The Chinese have been sitting on that DNA report for some years. And we didn't know that the Chinese had a high-ranking spy inside NSA who had access to this intelligence. So Snowden was in a very tricky position. He was a traitor. He had betrayed the DNA report to the Chinese. It wasn't the case that the Russian government was the first foreign government that he took the DNA report to. So his position was, shall we say, legally delicate. Had I been his attorney, I would have said you're in a slightly delicate position, Mr. Snowden.
I understand. Well, how many countries know about this or have seen the DNA report?
To my knowledge, the United States, the United Kingdom hasn't, but we're aware of it, obviously. The United States, the Chinese Federation, the Chinese People's Republic of China, and the Russian Federation. The only problem, of course, is that the intelligence is now all over the planet. There can't be an intelligence agency on the planet that isn't aware that the CIA did a DNA test, who isn't aware that I'm the one who gave the advice. Based, incidentally, on, we'd already done it in England, I'd given similar advice to MI5, because there was an issue about paternity involving a British Labour Party politician. The concern was that he was being blackmailed over his claimed paternity of a baby that had turned up suddenly and unexpectedly. I gave advice to MI5 as to how to organise a DNA report. The DNA bit is easy. It's extracting the DNA, which is difficult. And that involved getting DNA from a baby, the mother and the father, and the claimed father and the real father. And it was all done at a legal dinner, which I attended, which MI5 had somebody at on the caterers. And they liberated two wine glasses. The baby's saliva was, the baby's DNA was easy. You just wipe, you wipe the baby's saliva and there's your DNA. And somebody in MI5 had wanted to go to a government ministry with a needle.
I believe I read somewhere that you turned this information into Israel.
I have certainly briefed you. Of course I've briefed the Israelis. Mossad are extremely nice people. I do work with Mossad. Mossad are well aware, of course.
Are you aware of the Israelis conducting their own DNA test?
I've not heard that. It wouldn't surprise me, because the Israelis don't have a copy of it. The Russians, the Americans, and the Chinese have copies of it. The Israelis, as far as I know, don't have a copy of it. But the Israelis, I did tell the Israelis, of course, I talk to Israelis all the time, they're awfully nice people. I love Israel, and it's not a secret that I've had the odd drinkies with Mossad, who are awfully nice people. Love working with Mossad. Great people. And Mossad knew, Mossad have a very strong network in East Kenya. They've always had people on the ground in Mombasa. A lot of Israelis go to East Africa for holidays. And we had a threat, two friends of mine, in fact, worked on the threat to an Israeli airliner. And Al-Qaeda were trying to shoot the airliner down with a shoulder-fired a man pad. And two friends of mine worked on that case, one American for CIA and one for Mossad. In fact, they met up and didn't realize that the CIA didn't realize he was covering for Mossad and vice versa until they got there. And they were both friends of Michael. And my name came up because there was a bogus bar council complaint at the time, which had forced me out of the judiciary, and somebody had been running around fabricating documents and making up malicious, silly complaints, which I get all the time. And the CIA had done some background checks and actually rang me from Mombasa because I happened to be in Washington, and I got a briefing down an encrypted phone line via a satellite from Mombasa into the Willard Hotel. Always stay at the Willard when I can in Washington. Wonderful people. Look after you very well. The Israelis almost certainly were aware from that time about the DNA report, and I'm very, very confident. Sorry.
The reason I ask is because at one point someone anonymously contacted the Cold Case Posse investigators, claimed to be a Mossad agent, and said that they had conducted a DNA test, only they compared Barack Hussein Obama Jr. to Maya Satoru. I suspect that Madeleine Dunham may have been dead and therefore was not available to be tested.
This makes all sorts of sense. The Israelis would have the capacity to do their own DNA test. Of course they would. They wouldn't have the original DNA test in the CIA. We wouldn't give it to the Israelis. Of course the Israelis would do their own test. That makes complete sense to me. And of course they would have to do, they would not any longer be able to use Madeleine Dunham as a comparator. The grandfather had died in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. That makes complete sense to me. You can do DNA tests with collateral relatives.
Yes, and it was a very similar story about water glasses when Obama had met with Netanyahu, and I guess they followed Maya around until they were able to obtain a similar sample. Yeah,
that makes complete sense to me. And when Mike Zullo contacted me, he didn't refer to that. But
well, it was an anonymous source. The person never made contact again, so it was dismissed.
Well, he wouldn't, or she wouldn't. But that the Israelis, God bless them, were probably doing the right thing there. They were tipping off, because Obama, remember, has been ratting on Israel. The administration had been leaning on the Israelis over the peace process, so for both political reasons and as an act of friendship to the United States, I can well see Mossad doing that. I would not be at all surprised to find that that was in fact a genuine approach from a genuine all-singing, all-dancing Mossad agent.
Now, my understanding is that you have a trial of your own coming up. And
the theory, yes. That's a complete farce, yes. I'm accused of a bomb hoax. It's the only ring-back bomb hoax in history.
Wow.
Yes. Most of your listeners will say, hang on, a bomb hoax is normally associated with malicious anonymous phone calls. Who's ever heard of a bomb hoax where you ring up and you give your name and ring back number and the Ministry of Defense ring you back? It's a complete farce. Christopher Monckton, who I know, of course, for years, nice man. Christopher's ridiculed it this week in WND, and he's right. It's completely ridiculous.
Christopher's been on the show. In fact, Christopher Monckton was my very first guest a few years ago when I started the program. So.
Was he? Well, he was an excellent choice. He's a very sound man. Well, Christopher's had a go at the prosecution this week. It's a complete farce. It's a farce because it's a ring-back bomb hoax to a genuine name and number, and that's obviously inconsistent with bad faith. Obviously, I gave a briefing in good faith.
I would think that, based on what I know of you from our brief conversation, that you would, should you for some reason decide to do something like this, would be a little more cautious to prevent ramifications for yourself. So, yeah, that's now. I understand the trial
yes,
has been moved.
Briefing, yeah, exactly. Thank you. Yes, I didn't say there's a nuclear device in such and such a place in East London. The issue was, I had intelligence that was passed from a prosecution witness, which makes the prosecution even more of a farce. The intelligence I passed on was passed to me by a prosecution witness. And I went to the prosecution and said, you do understand the intelligence I gave to the Secretary of State for Defense, which was diverted to the Cabinet Office, came from a prosecution witness. And you've looked at my phone records, and this person rang me, and you know he rang me repeatedly on my mobile phone, cell phone, and at home. And you better take a second statement from him, because I'm going to ask him in the witness box. And they went and took a second statement from him, and he said, yes, I was Michael's source. I told Michael that there was a nuclear device in the East End of London. I obviously qualified the briefing. I'm not an idiot, at least I don't think I am. I'm a member of Mensa, so if I'm an idiot, I'm a Mensa-level idiot. I rang the Secretary of State's number in the House of Commons. I got a ring-back call from his private secretary, a man named Burton, and I explained to Mr. Burton, who's a prosecution witness, that this was the intelligence, that I believed it was credible, but it needed to be checked out. Of course, I didn't say, there is a nuclear device. That would be nonsense. The intelligence didn't go that far. I said, it's come from a credible source. He has provided accurate intelligence in the past. It's a statement about a missing nuclear warhead that was removed from the Soviet submarine or the Russian submarine Kursk in 2000. I know that nuclear weapons were removed from the Kursk. That has now been verified by someone involved in the actual recovery of the Kursk has said that she was carrying nuclear warheads. He can't say whether or not one was removed because the Russians are very, very cautious about access to the nuclear launch tubes, unsurprisingly. But I knew that a weapon had gone walkies from four nuclear weapons had gone walkies from the Kursk. The intelligence was very detailed, it was very specific, and it married with intelligence already in my possession about these four missing nuclear warheads. So my view was that it was something that had to be taken seriously. The intelligence needed to be verified. The only way of verifying it in our possession was using a Boeing E-3D Sentry aircraft doing a flypast, preferably at night, not to alarm people, over the east end of London. I spoke with an air marshal, who was former chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, acting chairman, he'd been deputy, official title was deputy chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, and the air marshal had explained to me that it would be possible for the Sentry to carry extra-sensitive radiation detection devices. He didn't go into detail. I knew the Sentry could carry those devices. I recommended that we sortie a Sentry to check out the intelligence. The Cabinet Office grounded the entire British Sentry fleet, which I didn't know when I had the conversation, found out later, and the explanation given for grounding the fleet, problems with the radar struts, was and is completely bogus. So the prosecution are going into court with a completely bogus story, which can be blown out of the water in 5 minutes, unsupported by any documentation, claiming a bomb hoax that was actually a ringbank bomb hoax for a nuclear device whose presence in the United Kingdom was verified by a National Reconnaissance Office satellite, Bumps and Daisy.
I'm a bit surprised this hasn't been thrown out already.
Sorry?
I said I'm a bit surprised this hasn't been thrown out already.
Well, but for politics, it would have been thrown out already. There's been heavy pressure from the Cabinet Office to keep this prosecution alive. It's, in fact, dead in the water. Everybody knows it's dead in the water. It's just a question of killing it off. If it goes to trial, it's going to be very entertaining indeed.
I understand the date of the trial has been moved. Some are speculating. It's been moved to take place after the United States midterm elections. Your thoughts on that?
Correct. It's been moved back till after the U.S. midterms. It's November 10th, 2014. But don't, as I say, I will alert the media, and if the trial goes ahead, it's going to be a media bun fight. It's going to be absolutely hilarious. And the prosecution are going to end up looking completely stupid. Christopher Monckton has already made them look fairly stupid. I'm hoping to complete the task and make them look completely stupid. As your listeners can probably tell, it's not a prosecution that is causing Michael any concerns.
Let me re-ask this question. I want to gain clarity on something. Do you believe, I know you said you don't give names, but do you believe that as this investigation moves forward and Sheriff Arpaio and Mike Zullo have some rather major announcements that they're going to be making, I don't want to get into the business of providing a timeline, but let's just say that I expect it to take place well before the midterm elections.
Yes,
when this moves forward. Do you believe that there will be members of the intelligence community who will come forward, honest, credible, patriotic citizens within the intelligence community who might be able to provide them with additional support? And might you even be able to encourage some of these people to do so?
I would certainly encourage anyone listening who's in the intelligence community, and this will obviously be monitored and picked up, I would encourage anyone with the truth to come forward and assist the proper US authorities. That seems to me to be only right. I will privately urge one or two people to make themselves known on this issue. I would not be surprised if patriotic US intelligence officers came forward.
Excellent. Now, Spy Hunter, it's already been released in the UK, occasionally when books aren't available through Amazon in the United States. I do order books from Amazon UK. The shipping is not that expensive. So this book is available, you know, via the magic of international courier to the people of the United States, perhaps not as conveniently as they would like at this moment. But what can you tell us about Spy Hunter? And then I'll let you put out any kind of a plug you want in terms of availability, how to get it, and so on.
Well, that's very kind of you. It's a 700-page intelligence text. It blows the gaff on all the major German spies in the United Kingdom, Russia, and the United States in World War II and afterwards, insofar as they're dead. Obviously, I can't name living German spies, not in a book, not without being sued for libel. The book is it's a major intelligence text. It was peer-reviewed during the course of its preparation. It's divided into three parts. The first part is autobiographical, tells people what I am and how I came to be in possession of such startling intelligence. Part two is historical, and it takes the story through to 1945, covers World War I, World War II, the growth of Germany, the role of intelligence in controlling the German state. And part three takes the story forward from World War II and explains that German intelligence was not shut down. Amongst the major German spies I've identified are Dwight Eisenhower, who was working for the Germans before, during, and after World War II, the Dulles brothers, Richard Helms, who was involved in the assassination for President Kennedy. He was the operational director for the Kennedy assassination, and General George Marshall and Ernest King. And those names probably won't cause surprise to the better informed of your listeners, and I know your listeners tend to be very well informed. I've also named major British spies working for the Germans, including Lord Louis Mountbatten, who betrayed the Canadians at Dieppe in World War II, very nasty piece of work, and who later surrendered India to a German asset called Nauru. I've identified, obviously, Nauru as a German asset. I've explained that the process of decolonization of the British Empire largely consisted of handing colonies over to German or Chinese client states, and that most of the so-called independence leaders were German or Chinese clients. I've outed Mao Zedong as a German asset. I've explained that the Germans bankrolled the Bolshevik revolutions in 1917, the Russian Revolution of 1905, and also the Chinese Communist Revolution. The Germans are backing the Chinese after 1940. They supported the communist side in the Chinese Civil War. I've explained that the Germans provided the pilots for the MiG-15s in the Korean War, and I've explained how a friend of mine and others in the U.S. intelligence community were involved in exposing that, and how that intelligence was kept under wraps, and it led to major intelligence failings during the Vietnam War, as intelligence did not pick up the fact that the instructors on the MiG-21s during the, as they were mostly during the Vietnam War, were in fact German, West German Luftwaffe pilots. And I've named a senior West German Luftwaffe general since dead, who was flying for the North Vietnamese Air Force during the Vietnam War. And I'm the chap who first told the Pentagon that, and I'm well aware that that nice man Donald Rumsfeld went across to Hanoi, and I understand he verified that from the North Vietnamese. And I can tell you his visit to Hanoi followed my visit to the Pentagon the week before. It's a I would like to think fairly interesting intelligence history. I'll also deal with high-yield offshore trading, the ways in which Germany sabotages Western economies. I've explained the German intelligence role in setting up the European Union. I've blown the gaff on the Savile paedophile ring, which was linked into Edward Heath and the then cabinet secretary. I've identified the first five cabinet secretaries as German spies. Your listeners will begin to understand why the Cabinet Office keep jumping over me. They're panicking about the fact that the first five Cabinet Secretaries from Maurice Hankey, known in the intelligence world as Hanky Panky, for the naughtinesses he got up to with little boys, the first five Cabinet Secretaries, all German spies, all identified in my book.
What type of response have you received from the press in the UK and various parts of the world?
Well, studiously ignoring it. I'm very glad to have the opportunity to talk about it. The mainstream media, 160 press releases were sent out to 160 media organisations in the UK. Only one, the quarterly magazine This England, has expressed interest in reviewing it. It's up to them whether they do or not. But the BBC, ITV, they've all had copies, or they're all aware of it. They're desperately trying to pretend that the book has not come out. But it has come out. It is published by June Press. It is available now to buy from amazon.co.uk or directly from the publishers at their website, www.junepress.com. At a very
we'll put a link on both the radio website and my Tea Party Power Hour elite website, where I put my interviews with some of my guests who have been more interesting, and I don't think it's too surprising that you've made the cut today.
That's right. You say so. Well, that's very gratifying, and we are in negotiations with one or two people in the States about U.S. distribution. To cut the costs for the American consumer, we would like to have the book printed in the States and distributed in the United States. I'm willing, if principle, to have it translated from English English to American English. I have already done that as the original.
Oh, that's so much fun for us, though. That's so much fun for us when we see the word loo instead of bathroom or lorry instead of truck. Well, we live for that here.
I have had the view expressed that it would be better off leaving it in the original English English because that's more authentic. The original publisher was going to be American, and I had, at her insistence, I translated it all from English to American, if your listeners will forgive that slight tongue-in-cheek expression. And that's partly why the book was delayed. She got wet feet. I think there were representations. Anyway, she got wet feet and pulled out. By that stage, the whole book had been translated into American. I thought, oh, dear. So I went to June Press, who are very nice people, and they said, well, we'll publish it, but it's got to be in English. You've got to translate it back from American to English. So that caused another 3 months delay, and that's why it is only now emerging in the spring of 2014. We should have had it out no later than the fall of 2013. And, of course, if the Cabinet Office hadn't raided my house and seized all my working papers and my backup copies, it would have been out by the end of 2012, and that might have saved a few hundred lives, because I have covered the TWA-800 shootdown and the shootdown of Air France 447 and the Omenia Airbus, all brought down by Phoenix missiles fired from launch towers fed into the end of the conning towers of launch silos fitted into the end of the conning towers of Kilo-class submarines. Launch tubes is a better expression. We use silos for ballistic missiles, launch tubes fed into the back of the conning tower of the Kilo-class submarines. The submarine surfaces, stays hull down, fires the missile in semi-active mode. It tracks onto the radar of the airliner. The pilots don't know that they're being targeted deliberately, and they're blown out of the sky, and they don't know what's happening. They don't know why. And that's why poor old Captain Shah didn't know what to do when he saw a missile heading towards his plane. He didn't realize that it was targeted at him, obviously.
Michael, I've been joking with Mike Zulo for some time that when this is all over, we're going to hold what I've decided to call the Birther's Ball, which is going to be a grand occasion where everyone who's had any type of role in this is going to be invited so we can gloat over our victory. And I will make certain that you receive an invitation.
Well, that's very gracious of you, and I look forward to attending. As I always tell my intelligence students, always tell the truth. Don't bother varnishing it. Just tell it as it is. Don't worry about how people are going to react or whether how it looks. Doesn't matter how it looks. If it's true, stick with the truth.
Absolutely. Eventually it will come out.
Eventually,
Michael Shrimpton, ladies and gentlemen, author of the new book Spy Hunter, available through Amazon UK and through the publisher. We'll get those links up on our website real soon. Michael, thank you for being here today. It was an honor having you on the show, and we look forward to having you back again to, well, for no other reason, to gloat over our victory. You know, we can do that.
I'm always willing to come on the show, always willing to talk to our friends in the Tea Party, and we hope there'll be a sensible Tea Party candidate for 2016. Governor
Hopefully Pender. An eligible one.
And preferably one who's a U.S. citizen.
Yes, that's what
I said.
One who's
actually eligible, yes.
That's
not
what I was saying.
Cruise.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillard.